Birds are such a wonder to watch and to listen to. Even if you're just listening to what's around you when you're out running errands or working in the garden, there's so much to take in. But how do we know what we're hearing? Hi, I'm Judith Sears Poisson, sitting in for Larry Mueller. Thanks for spending your Labor Day with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. As is the case for most holidays, we have two expert and passionate bird watchers with us to share their love and knowledge of birds. Noel Cutright is a past president of the Wisconsin Society for Ornithology. Noel, thanks so much for spending your holiday with us.
Well, this is one of the highlights of my year, spending some time with you folks.
Well, thank you, Noel. The same goes for us. And for Bill Volker, too, I'm guessing. Bill has been watching and studying birds for nearly 40 years, and in his travels has sighted more than 2,500 species. That's a quarter of the world's birds. He spent 27 years as a naturalist at Horicon Marsh right here in Wisconsin. And Bill, always a pleasure to have you with us as well.
Well, thank you, Judith. Great to be with you and all your listeners, and thank you for laboring on Labor Day.
Well, it's a labor of love, I think, for all of us. And we certainly want to invite our listeners in to join in as callers at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Any questions, comments, sightings you have that you want to share with us, or ask Bill and Noel what you're seeing with the birds around where you're living, we'd be happy to have you join in. You can also email us at talk@wpr.org or post a question, comment, or a bird photo on our Facebook page. That's The Larry Mueller Show. Well, you know, it is starting to feel a little fall-like out there. I actually wore jeans today instead of something a little cooler. But, you know, when does the fall migration begin and end in Wisconsin? Noel, when can we expect the most activity?
Well, it's really dependent upon various groups of species of birds. They each have their time when they typically start migrating and during the peak and then when they're pretty well winding down. So you really can't talk about in generalities because the fall migration really starts in July and goes all the way until when there's snow on the ground. So it's a very long period. But each of our species has its own kind of period of time. We often think of shorebirds migrating pretty early, like in late summer, early fall. The peak of shorebird migration for most species has probably already passed, but there's still a lot moving through. And last night was a wonderful night. I don't know if anyone went out and listened to all the little chirps and chips, chip notes that were being uttered under the cover of darkness last night, but the radar showed that there was a nice movement. And I've had one report from Fond du Lac County this morning that said it was just a terrific migration early this morning.
And was that of shorebirds or other types of birds, Noel?
All kinds of birds, including waders like black-crowned night herons. This fall counted over 6,000 blackbirds migrating across some of the marshes up in Fond du Lac County. So it really depends, again, on the species. But, you know, warblers have been moving for a while. Some of the warblers move really quite early in late summer, early fall. Others don't start migrating until later, like yellow-rumped warblers haven't even thought about migrating yet, I don't believe. They're one of the latest warblers that migrate into Wisconsin, through Wisconsin.
Well, and we will actually, I have some audio of a yellow-rumped warbler that we can listen to, but let's go back a little bit to those shorebirds and waders. You said, Noel, that a lot of the shorebirds actually have moved out already, but I'm guessing, you know, there's still some around. Bill, what are some tips you have for to share for watching those shorebirds and waders successfully this time of year?
Well, like any bird, you've got to go to the appropriate habitat, and perhaps that's one reason why shorebirds aren't noticed so much by the general public. They're very much habitat specialists. They wander from the shallow mud flats and moist soil areas. So now, late summer, if we've had a bit of a lack of rain for a while, wetlands are starting to recede, shorelines are starting to become exposed, and this is really ideal. A lot of these birds are what we refer to as peckers and probers. So in other words, they're either just walking on the mud or saturated soil or actually wading into the shallow water. Birds with the very small beaks are just picking the invertebrates right off of the surface or just slightly into the mud. Others are actually probing deep into there for that very protein-rich food. They're fueling up because most of these birds are heading well into South America, incredibly long flights, and they're also coming down from the Arctic. Mm. So they've already traveled, for many of these birds, well over 1,000 miles to get here, are now loading up on fuel, and some of them will have as much as 6,000 or 8,000 more miles to go from here.
And we do have up on the Facebook page a link to, it's a Google map that's the 2013 Wisconsin shorebirding locations, and it's created specifically to direct bird watchers to areas being managed for migratory shorebirds by the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources. So that's a great resource to have.
Absolutely. And as I said, because these birds are somewhat habitat specialists, and if you think about just the right conditions of just a few inches of water and saturated soil along the edge of these wetlands or flooded fields, well, that changes very quickly, both from week to week and certainly from year to year. And so these birds are used to moving around to where they can find that ideal feeding ground. And, of course, that means that bird watchers need to be a little bit vigilant of just where are the ideal conditions and where these birds concentrating for those few weeks as they're passing through.
As you said, those conditions can change quickly, too. So the DNR is also encouraging birders to submit their sightings to Wisconsin eBird so that they can track the migratory shorebird populations and other birders know what's going on. Noel, can you tell us a little bit about the eBird, Wisconsin eBird, and why that's important?
This is a way to track sightings electronically, so it's a great way to keep track, and there's just millions and millions of records in there from people now pretty much all over the world entering their sightings into eBird. And, of course, the larger the database that we have, the more that we can compile the information and learn about, you know, where the birds are and when they're coming and going. When we talk about migration and where the concentration areas are, we can identify stopover locations, which are very important during migration. We can find out where the birds are overwintering. So it's just a wonderful resource to have here in the state to be able to track our comings and goings.
And, Bill, do you use eBird regularly, both contributing information and using the information that's there?
I don't use it regularly, but I'm certainly very familiar with it. And I'll tell you what I see as the real gem to eBird, and that is that in order to keep track of birds, we've always relied on professionals to do their studies or through something like the Wisconsin Society for Ornithology or other statewide organizations. Field notes compilers have gathered bird watchers' data and tried to use that to keep a little track of both rare occurrences, the regular movements and occurrence of birds, and even some of their densities. The problem is that trying to tabulate all of that by hand, by the time everybody writes it down, submits it, you go through it, it's 6 months later before we even get some sort of a handle on what happened, you know, the previous season.
Which is good for historical information, but not so much for being able to jump in and see what's going on.
Exactly. So we actually have millions of people who have binoculars who are watching birds, and certainly a lot more casual bird watchers than there are professional scientists, and certainly there are certain studies that require very specific scientific investigations and techniques. But we thought this would be a fantastic way to utilize literally millions of people's eyes and to instantly tabulate their sightings from all across the continent. And it just gives us an incredible picture. And as Noel said, the larger the data set, the more we get the accuracy of what's really happening with these birds. Well, we get a million people out there who are all submitting their bird watching sightings. We start to get a really good idea of what's happening all across the country in much greater detail than what just a small core of dedicated scientists could be able to tell us.
It's really exciting for all of us to take advantage of. We're talking with Noel Cutright and Bill Volker today. They are both experienced and passionate birders, and they're happy to share what they know with you and hear what you've been seeing as well. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson sitting in for Larry Mueller today. And Bill, one of the birds that you suggested that we might want to listen to some audio of is a green heron. And so why don't I play that, and then you can tell us about that bird. So, Bill, why did you want to listen to the green heron specifically?
Well, this has just been a favorite experience of mine just because it is such a very short, very subtle fall migration occurrence. Throughout the summer, green herons are found around lake shores and wetlands and flying from one place to the next. Once they settle in and start to fish or rest, they become somewhat reclusive, and that little call that you just played is certainly very diagnostic of the bird. And anybody who's around water during the summertime should be hearing that. It's usually described as a skjell, a very throaty, guttural type of a croak that we hear. A number of years ago, I was coming home from work, and I saw green herons just before sunset flapping around in a very animated type of way, very deep wing beats, and they were giving a call I had never heard before. And it's more like a real short kirp, kirp. And as they were flying, all of a sudden, others were rising up, joining the flock. They went around the lake one more time, and just as the sun went down, they caught a north wind and headed out. I see this about every 2 or 3 years. It only happens for, I'd say, somewhere between about 2 minutes to 3 minutes in an evening, right with a north wind. Last night was probably the great north wind that we had, the front coming through, but a little early for green herons, probably in the next 10 days and when the conditions are right. And I've referred to this as the assembly call. They mm-hmm. literally are calling the other herons. They're rising up, joining the flock, and they decide just to go. And it's always astounding that there they go, that's it.
Wow.
Won't see them until next spring. And so a very peculiar behavior and something that I've been noticing throughout the fall time, usually about the 7th to the 15th of September, with a few late ones right toward the end of September as they're departing. But always just before sunset when we get a cool front coming through with a north wind.
Wow. And do you have any sense of which bird or birds would have the responsibility for kind of mustering the troops there?
No, that's always the hard thing to determine because essentially they all look alike. The young have grown up, males and females, we really can't distinguish them from by sight. And so we really don't know who is who in among the flock. And that would require actually capturing, marking the birds, differentiating a little bit of who's who. So there's always that mystery. We really don't know beyond that what's going on and who decides, or you know, some birds will actually linger till the next north wind comes through and others will decide to join the train and go right then. But there is essentially, for most birds, there's two main things that drive that migration. First of all, they know the time of year to go because it's determined by the photo period, the day length. Anybody knows right now it's getting dark a lot earlier than it was back in late June, early July. So the birds begin to sense that already as we get into that mid-late summer. That's the signal that it's getting to be that time to go. The actual day they go, well, Noel referred to this earlier. Last night was a great movement of birds. Why? We had a cold front come through, and behind that, cool air and a north wind. Birds like to move on those winds, and that's why Noel said, watch the radar, because not only is the weatherman watching the weather systems, but we can see the birds are literally riding on those weather systems. Why not take advantage of that if you got a long way to go?
Judith, it's probably the first bird that has a stronger urge to fly and to start migrating than the others. And when it gets up, it just goes ahead and calls, and the others respond. So I don't think there's not a designated leader or anything like that, or a commander of the flock of green herons. It's just a bird that gets up, has the strongest urge to migrate, and probably gets airborne and gives that call that Bill described.
And Noel, do most migrating birds do that assembling behavior to go in a group?
No, they don't. Most of our birds, and there are certainly some exceptions, are pretty much migrate alone. They might form loose flocks. Birds that migrate during the day, I mean, for example, the red-winged blackbirds that were observed today, they migrate primarily after light, not during the dark. So they will often fly in flocks. Shorebirds that migrate during the day or when it's still visible very often be in flocks. But most of our nocturnal migrants, some may flock, such as a waterfowl, a flock of geese. They'll stay together. They'll talk to each other and be able to stay as assembled as a group. But most of our birds are up there alone, even though they do give these chip notes so they can kind of keep track of each other or communicate. We don't know what they're communicating or why they're communicating, but they do make chip notes for the most part during the flight, during migration. But it's not much of an organization flock as we think of it.
We're going to talk more about birds and bird watching with Noel Cutright and Bill Volkert, and we will get to your calls, too. We have several people waiting to join the conversation right after this short break. Stay with us. Coming up at 6 o'clock today, To the Best of Our Knowledge examines seeing and perceiving, including an interview with neurologist Oliver Sacks. That's today at 6 o'clock here on the Ideas Network. But right now, we're talking with birders Bill Volkert and Noel Cutright about the fascinating birds that call Wisconsin home for all or part of the year. And Noel and Bill, we have several people waiting to join the conversation, so let's go to the phones and Ron in Newburgh. Hi, Ron.
Yes, good morning. I was, Bill and Noel, I just accidentally went along the northeast side of Teresa Marsh last weekend, and you're right, there, the water level was down, and there were egrets and sandhills and a whole bunch all over the place along the shore. But anyhow, my question is, normally towards mid-August or something, there's too many wasps at my hummingbird and oriole feeders, and I just give up on it, and that's it for the year. Well, this year the wasps didn't come, and I hadn't put sugar or grape jelly out in early August, and now they're just in here like no tomorrow. I think I've been going through 3 quarts of grape jelly a week, and then the sugar water. Well, there the orioles tend to land on the hummingbird feeder and shake the sugar water out of it. But it's still far more than what I've ever seen that I recall at this time of year that the orioles and hummingbirds are just bombing through here.
Huh. And let's see what Bill and Noel have to say. Bill, is that something you've been observing as well?
Well, I've got orioles coming to my hummingbird feeders as well. And, of course, they're loading up because they're going to be heading out fairly shortly. And as Ron indicated, he's got an extraordinary number this year, maybe a family group in the neighborhood or two that just happened to find his food and take advantage of it, whether those were local nesting birds or birds that are just beginning to move around the neighborhood and around the area a bit in preparation for migration. They certainly found his backyard and are taking advantage of it. And I think this is typical where from year to year, you may not see or have very few visitors of one species, and then all of a sudden one year, they all seem to find your backyard. And I guess those are the joys of watching birds, that things are never quite the same.
Noel, have you had any birds in large numbers this year as compared to other years, or some that you haven't seen very many of that are usual visitors?
Well, the orioles kind of slacked off there in late summer, mid to late summer. They nested, and they kind of got scarce for a while. But here in the last 2 weeks, they've been regularly been seen at our feeders as the hummingbirds have. I'm seeing very few yellow jackets this year at my place, which is really, really neat, even though my son-in-law and dog got stung this weekend when they discovered a nest when they were romping around in the field next to the house. There's just not many hummingbirds, and doesn't seem like the yellow jackets, the hummingbirds aren't being bothered too much by competition with yellow jackets at the feeders this year. One of the exciting things that we have here in the state this year, there's a number of dedicated people that do bird banding, so we can learn more about the comings and goings of birds through that technique. We now have a person who is trained to band hummingbirds. That person has to have spatial training. They have to make their own bands. But we now have an official hummingbird bander, and she is looking for locations with a good concentration so she can keep up with her training. And hopefully later in the fall, when some of these more uncommon hummingbirds show up, which is something that's been happening more and more as the years go by, we'll have somebody that can go out and capture those late fall hummingbirds and put bands on them. And again, we can start learning more about their comings and goings here in Wisconsin.
I cannot even imagine how tiny a band for a hummingbird leg would have to be.
Yeah, they have to have a spatial little shears to cut the metal out and form them. And it takes, once you've handled a hummingbird, it's just like, it's just almost like magic to be able to handle something that tiny and be able to manipulate their legs and get the bands on, record all the data. It takes some skill.
Wow. Well, you, Noel, said that you have not had a lot of problems with yellow jackets, but I think Earl in Germantown has been having a different experience. So, Earl, what's going on with you?
Yeah, Bill and Noel, I sure do. And I'm allergic to bees, so I got to tiptoe through the tulips when I fill my oriole feeder and hummingbird feeder. So right now I've got maybe two families of orioles that come around, and they're still here, and they feed pretty heavy, but the wasps are really thick. And I'm wondering if there is a good container around that is kind of like an anti-bee type thing that is available. What I did this morning before I went out and filled up the container, I took the garden hose out and put it on a fine mist, and that seemed to take care of the bees for a while until I had a chance to get in there and fill the container up again. But I'm just wondering if there's any type of container that is kind of a anti-bee thing, because I'm allergic to them, and when I get stung, well, it's EpiPen time, you know.
So Earl would like to keep feeding the birds, but not be feeding the bees. Any suggestions for that, Bill?
Well, hummingbird feeders do come with bee guards, and it's sort of a perforated little cup that sits in front so that it keeps enough distance usually between those drops of water, the sugar water, for the bees are not able to reach it, but the hummingbirds with their longer beak are able to reach between there. That, I guess, is at least a deterrent for the bees. I wouldn't say it's 100% foolproof. I've got problems this year of bald-faced hornets around the feeders, and when I go to bring them down and change them again, yeah, I've got to watch my timing a little bit so as not to disturb them. The other problem is that you could try a little bit of a trap. A common one is just take a small dish with some real sweet soda and put some soap, dish soap on top so that the bees are attracted to that. As soon as they touch that dish soap, essentially they saturate their wings, get glued to it, and end up drowning. But it's really hard to lure them to that when you've got the hummingbird feeder right there. It's almost like trying to live trap a woodchuck in the garden by putting carrots and apples in a trap. When you've got so much food around, why would they go in the trap? So, yeah, it can be a little challenging.
And let's go next to Judy in Oshkosh, because she has a question about orioles as well. Hi, Judy.
Hi. I'm so glad you're talking about orioles, because I thought they were done for the year. I'm glad I tuned in today. I always put my oriole feeder out in April and then watch the orioles come around Memorial Day, and then they taper off significantly in June, and I just kept researching and trying to find on the internet when do the orioles actually leave Wisconsin and start going back, and I thought, well, maybe they start their migration really early. I could not find any answers on that, because I don't get, after that time period, I don't get any more orioles at my feeder anymore, and I assumed they were gone, and now I hear you talking about orioles again, and I thought, oh my gosh, am I missing something, because I didn't put any more grape jelly out. I think I missed some.
Well, and so is there a general time frame of when the orioles arrive and when they leave, Noel?
Around the 1st of May, they arrive. Again, that can vary from year to year. I mean, this was a late spring this year. Last spring was a very early spring. But, you know, the 1st of May is kind of a target. And they'll still be in the state into September through September. So, you know, the spring migration is much quicker. Much more of a pulse that comes. Things are much more leisurely in the fall. You know, the weather's still good. There's a lot of fruit and insects around. And, you know, they're not in a hurry to set up their territories and start breeding and finding a mate and laying eggs and going through that whole process. The fall is much more leisurely, so there's not these pulse movements that we get in the spring during the fall time. But we'll have orioles here in Wisconsin throughout September.
And one of the things that we wanted to talk about was whether there's any connection between when birds arrive in the spring and then when they decide to leave in the fall. Does that order of the birds arriving affect when they leave in the fall, Bill?
I wouldn't say it affects it, but there's certainly a very strong correlation, and essentially the first to arrive are the last to leave, and some of the last birds to arrive in these northern states are also the first to leave. And the reason for that is it's driven by food. And commonly, I've gone over this time and again with groups that I've talked to at this time of the year. The general thing that I hear from people is, well, it's starting to get cold out and the birds have to go south. Yes, that's true that it's starting to cool down and birds are migrating, but it's not the cold that drives it, but it's what the cold brings, which is frost, snow, and ice. And that essentially eliminates the food supply. So these summer birds, our songbirds, are getting ready to leave right now, because as we get closer into our fall season, it's more and more likely we're going to have a good killing frost. And for birds that are insectivores, that food will disappear almost overnight. So they've got to anticipate that frost, get ready right now, and leave long before the earliest good killing frost so that they're well on their way. Waterfowl can hang around well into the season because they're feeding in the water. So the herons, the coots, the ducks, they need open water to access their food. Once that starts to freeze over, there's plenty of food. They just can't reach it. And then finally, the late birds, such as red-winged blackbirds, the sandhill cranes, Canada geese, these are mostly upland feeders. They can find food in picked grain fields and abandoned fields and other places until the snow starts to accumulate so much that they no longer have that access. And so in springtime, the snow first melts, then the ice starts to give way, and eventually the soil warms up and the insects hatch. And it goes in that same order. First we see the insects either being killed by the frost or driven into dormancy, then ice starts to form on lakes and wetlands, and eventually the snow starts to stay on the ground. And so different birds are responding to those food shortages or food availability.
We're talking with birders Bill Volkert and Noel Cutright. As often we do on holidays, they are spending the whole 90 minutes with us talking about birds and bird watchings. And the phones are full right now, but when there is an open line, you can call 1-800-642-1234. And of course, you can email us at talk@wpr.org or post a question, comment, or a bird photo on our Facebook page. That's The Larry Mueller Show. Robin Cherry, our on-air producer today, happy to take your calls and emails and get those in to us. And Bill, you just mentioned red-winged blackbirds, and Marcia commented on Facebook, "The kids and I were lucky to be outside this morning when a large river of birds burst through the trees nearby. My husband used binoculars to ID them as red-winged blackbirds." That sounds like it would be quite something to see, doesn't it, Bill?
Oh, absolutely. And this is the time of year that these birds are flocking up and starting to form these larger and larger groups. And also, as we get into October and even early November, get to a large cattail marsh just around sunset, and you'll see sometimes streams of blackbirds. We used to watch at Horicon Marsh sometimes a quarter mile or even a half mile long as these flocks just get bigger and bigger and bigger, and they come into there for the evening roost. One thing I think people should be aware of is that this flocking behavior we're seeing of birds right now, while some birds are certainly migrating and moving through and even departing from Wisconsin, others, like red wings, may not move for quite some time, or even, say, Canada geese. The migrants haven't even arrived yet from up in Canada, and the local birds are just flocking. So they're no longer rearing young. Those have grown up. They're no longer tied to the nest. So now they are much more mobile, and they're starting to form flocks, and even for some of these birds, migration may be weeks away. We're starting to see this flocking behavior and feeding. So there's also this preparation for some birds that may not migrate for some time, but they certainly are flocking and starting to gather up. But departure may be some time away yet for some of those late migrants.
Well, Judith, I have something for Earl. He asked about a trap.
Yes.
You can make a very simple yellow jacket trap. All you need is like a large 2-liter bottle, soda bottle sort of thing. Put about a half a cup of water. I mean, you don't have to be real fine on these measurements, but a half a cup of water. Put a quarter cup of sugar in, shake it till it dissolved. Add a cup of apple cider vinegar into it and shake it up until that's all together. And then stick a banana peel down in the jar. And add more water until the jar is about half full, and then cut a hole in the cap big enough for a yellow jacket to enter. And set it out there and watch them come, and they'll crawl inside because they're attracted to the sugar, vinegar, banana peel. And, of course, they'll go in the bottle and end up drowning in the water, in the fluid that's in the bottle. So
this is a way to basically tempt them away from the feeders. And then once they go after this, they're done for.
They'll find that even more attractive probably in your sugar water.
All right. Well, after the show, I'll write that up and put that up on Facebook. So
cocktail.
Yeah, I was going to say, yeah, sugar, vinegar, and banana peel. wouldn't draw me, but, you know, I'm not the goal. Well, we were talking a little bit about some of the birds that will actually stay around for several more weeks, and I want to let people know that we decided it was just too long to go between Labor Day and Thanksgiving to have Bill and Noel on, so they will be on together again on Tuesday, October 1st. So we'll get to talk about a lot more of those waterfowl migrations and things that are going on then. But in the meantime, Bill, you suggested that we listen to tundra swans and Canada geese, since those are two that might be hard for people to distinguish. So let's take a listen first to the tundra swan. So that was the tundra swan, and now let's listen to the Canada goose. All right, so Bill, how would you compare those two?
Well, to my ears, the Canada goose is a little more raucous, a little harsher call, sort of a broken two-note call, and I think something that everybody's familiar with. They're just in almost every corner of Wisconsin. The tundra swan, to me, is much softer, more of a moaning call, somewhat reminiscent, but it doesn't have that harshness that you hear in the Canada goose. Tundra swans will be coming down from Alaska and from the Arctic, coming through Wisconsin as we get into about mid-October. Some will start showing up in early October. So right now, the Canada geese are the local giants that are starting to flock and move around the state. By about the 15th to the 20th of September, the first migrants will start coming down from Canada to join that flock, and they'll be building up as we go through fall.
And Noel, those tundra swans that will be coming down in a month or so, where are they on their way to ultimately?
You know, tundra swans have an interesting path. They breed up in Alaska for the most part, so they're way up in the northwestern part of North America, and they're heading for the Chesapeake for the most part over on the Atlantic coast. So they go from the northwest to the southeast, and that takes them across Wisconsin very often, both in the spring and the fall. So, and they're one of the, you know, the large-bodied bird, and they can handle pretty tough weather. So they're one of the earliest migrants in the spring and one of the latest migrants in the fall. They won't be coming through until, you know, late October into November. And sometimes we actually been seeing some still on Christmas count in December.
Hmm. And let's go next to Scotty in Eagle River, who has a suggestion for all of us. Hi, Scotty.
Hi.
Hi, go ahead.
I read one of my bird magazines once and have tried this, and it really helps with the bees and hornets and stuff around people's hummingbird feeders. Because we don't want to kill off any more bees than we need to. We have too few as it is. But if you would just take your finger and smear a little bit of vegetable oil over the, what they were talking about, the bee guard on the hummingbird feeder, that mesh bee guard, and it'll sit on the little flower thing down below where the water might drip. The hornets and bees do not like getting that oil on their feet, and that it doesn't bother the hummingbirds. And it really, really worked well for me. The only thing is you have to be vigilant about cleaning that, because it will get kind of thick and a little bit sticky as the season goes on. So you rub it off and just put a new batch of just rub it on. You don't have, it doesn't have to be thick. And you'll see the hornets will land and they'll leave right away. And eventually they just learn they don't want to be there.
Well, thanks for that, Scotty. And Noel, that sounds like it might be actually a good good complement to what you were suggesting, because maybe some would still go to the feeder, and that way it would be even less appealing to them over there.
And I certainly agree with Scotty with what's happening with our pollinating insects. They are really getting hit by we don't know what. But populations of especially things like bumblebees are really depressed, and there's a lot of concern, and people are planting gardens now for pollinators to hopefully help them. And there's just significant declines in many of our pollinators. So there's a lot of concern and action going on to try to figure out what we can do to enhance populations. We don't know whether it's changes in habitat, whether it's pesticides, a combination of factors, but just like we're seeing some of our frogs and toads mm-hmm. and salamanders declining, birds declining, we're also seeing bees declining. The biggest hassle, yes, bald-faced hornets will come to hummingbird feeders, but, you know, the biggest one is yellow jackets. And I don't think anyone's too concerned about overall populations of yellow jackets.
I think most of us would agree with that. Janet in Marshfield has been waiting a bit, so let's go there. Hi, Janet.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a set of cardinals. The female is very strangely colored. She's orange on her belly and the top of her head and the face. But she, otherwise, she's the shape, and she's got the tuft like a regular cardinal. And her mate is mostly brown, but has some red on its in its tail. And they just arrived a couple days ago.
Hmm.
And the other cardinals that are here do not like them at all. They chase them away all the time, but they keep coming back. Do you think they migrated from somewhere?
Well, Janet, let's see what Bill Volkert has to say. Bill, what do you think?
Well, first of all, cardinals are non-migratory. They're with us year-round. Yes, there are local movements of these birds, and there's always some dispersal so that we don't have localized inbreeding over time. Probably what she's seeing are the young of the year. Males are bright red. The females have that nice tawny brown color. Young ones, whether they're male or female, are born or hatched out looking like the female. They will look very similar to her. The female, the adult, has a adult female has a reddish bill. The young both have dark brown bills and are slowly starting to attain those colors. That orange one, I'm wondering if that isn't a male that's starting to get the first of the adult plumage coming through and starting to get a little bit of the first showing of the red.
Noel, do you have a sense of why the other cardinals would seem to not like having them around?
Well, I think they just react to something that's different. You know, how as a kid, other kids will single out the kid that looks a little different or has a different behavior and pick on him. Birds and other species of animals do the same sort of thing sometimes. And I agree with Bill. The orange one is probably a male. It may be just one that has some different color pigments on it that hasn't made it completely red, or maybe a young bird that hasn't attained its full plumage. And the one she describes as brown is probably the female. But, there is differences in how pigment is displayed in birds. Some are a little off every once in a while. But as Bill mentioned, cardinals are non-migratory and could very well be young birds that just showed up.
As someone who went prematurely gray, I have to say I have a soft spot for those oddly colored oddly colored birds. Well, let's go to Marion in Dodgeville next, who also has a color question. Hi, Marion.
I think you're looking for Marlin.
Oh, Marlin. I'm sorry about that.
Yeah,
even with my reading glasses on, I read it wrong.
Okay. I have a couple of questions about orioles and something that I've seen this year that I've never seen before, maybe because I haven't been observant, but do orioles change color in the late summer?
All right, let's see what Bill has to say. Bill, what do you think?
No, not really, but there is a two-year plumage to the male, so the young ones from this year will look quite different, somewhat like the female. The first-year males will look different from the adult males and any of the female plumage. So there is variation between the adult male, the adult female, and the juvenile birds and first-year birds. So there isn't a real big change in the color. I've watched where some of these birds will change quite dramatically between spring and fall. I've watched orioles on the wintering ground down in Central America, and the adult males are just as brilliant orange as they are up here.
Well, thanks for that call, Marlon. And we are talking with Noel Cutright and Bill Volkert. They are experienced and passionate bird watchers, and they are happy to answer your questions when you call 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email us at talk@wpr.org. What birds have you been seeing a lot of lately? Wonder what their behavior means? We'd love to have you join the conversation. Stay tuned. We are talking about birds and bird watching with Bill Volkert, a naturalist and retired wildlife educator at Horicon Marsh International Education Center, and Noel Cutright, who is past president of the Wisconsin Society for Ornithology. As always, thanks for spending the holiday with us, Bill and Noel.
Happy to, and I'd be remiss if I didn't alert your listeners to a couple of wonderful migratory sites, I guess, to try to take in.
Oh, great. Sure.
One is during late August, early September, we have significant movements of nighthawks, common nighthawks. In the evening skies, you can look up and sometimes see hundreds. There's been reports at certain lookouts where people are looking over an extended period of time, even into the thousand. Nighthawks are related to whippoorwills.
Hmm.
They're heading for the tropics, so they're migrating through Wisconsin now. They've got very long, angular wings with white splotches on them, and they dart around and they catch all the insects they catch on the wing. So many people have been reporting good numbers of nighthawks migrating in the evening skies this time of year. And about that same time of evening are chimney swifts gathering together to go to roost down chimneys. And they're moving, and we've had a number of activities. We're encouraging people to conduct chimney swift watches, where they'll go out and stake out a chimney that the swifts are using and try to get counts. And again, sometimes we can get into hundreds of chimney swifts going down one chimney to roost at night.
I wonder if people mistake them for bats.
They could, but bats typically are not going to go in chimneys. They'll go in other locations.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a little similarity in bat flights and chimney swift flights, but you see birds, and of course chimney swifts nest in chimneys also. They build their nests on the walls of inside the chimneys. But this time of year, they're looking for places to roost during migration. And again, you can get significant numbers. And they go in really late. They form a swirling vortex over the chimney, and almost they just dive straight down into the chimney to roost for the night.
Wow, that sounds amazing to see. And, Bill, you were mentioning the wintering areas earlier, and you're leading a trip to Nicaragua in February. Tell us what happens on one of those trips.
Well, this is the first time I'm going to take a group down with me. I've been working in Nicaragua for the last 11 years on a number of bird conservation and education projects, and I just thought I would share the experience. The group is full. We're going to take a group of 10 people down, and I'm also putting together a book. The manuscript is finished up pretty much. I certainly want to thank Noel for being one of the reviewers of that. And it's a book on where to watch birds in Nicaragua. So to kick off the book and to share the experience, we've got a group of 10 people, and we're going to be visiting a number of the premier bird watching sites just outside of Managua, Granada, and up into the northern highlands. And then as an extension to the trip, at the end, we're going to go down in the rainforest in the far southeast along the San Juan River. And there's a lodge. It's a long drive to get down to a little town from there, a 3.5-hour boat ride down the river, and then we're going to be hanging out at the lodge there and see some spectacular wildlife and really a lot of different habitats of the country. The interesting thing is it's not only a chance to see all kinds of exotic wildlife, but we'll be down there in our winter, so we'll see so many of our migrants and actually get an understanding of where these birds are going to, the habitats they depend on, and what we need to do to take care of them on the other end as much as we do up here.
And Bill's website is up on our Facebook page. You can go there to follow the link, or you can just go there directly. It's Bill Volkert, VOLKERT.com. So BillVolkert.com. And I have to say, I've been fortunate to spend quite a bit of time in Nicaragua over the years, and it's an amazing country and sometimes overlooked, I think, for travelers. So that sounds great. Bill, you are also going to be heading to Europe soon on a bird-related trip. Tell us about that.
We had some German ornithologists in Wisconsin about 3 years ago. They came here as part of the Horicon Bird Festival and to enjoy our spring migration. and I received invitation to join them on their fall crane surveys. The close relative to the sandhill crane, what's called the common crane, is migrating across Europe now. They are coming down from Scandinavia and far northwest Russia. And north of Berlin, they get concentrations of cranes of, well, almost like we get geese, or say the cranes down at Jasper Pulaski. Something like 50 to 70,000 cranes will gather there as they are now staging and stopping over. And eventually, they'll be heading down towards southern Spain, northern Africa, and around the Mediterranean. So just as we are both watching and monitoring our birds here, they're doing the same. And I received an invitation to join the ornithologists and tour around some of the newly created wetland reserves in that region between Berlin and the Baltic. And my family comes from the area. I still have cousins in the area south of Berlin, so I'll be visiting with them as well and taking a little bit of a chance to do some bird watching on the other side and enjoy their fall migration.
Sounds great. We'll want to hear all about that. Let's go to Spring Green and Jeannie, who's up next. Hi, Jeannie.
Hi. I love the show today. Thank you.
Sure.
I'm calling because I have a remedy for bees and hornets that hang out at your hummingbird feeders. I hang a few of those safety pops, the little lollipops with the string handles, near the feeder. And when the bees and hornets get used to that, they'll just be drawn to it like a magnet. I slowly move it away, and it works great.
So you catch them near the feeder, but then the lollipops.
Yeah.
And then you just start moving them further away from the feeders.
Right. It works great.
Well, great. Thank you so much for sharing that.
Thanks, Judy.
And let's go back and talk a little bit more about feeding hummingbirds with Mary and Cable. Hi, Mary.
Hi.
Hi.
Several years ago, a friend of mine told me that if I don't stop feeding hummingbirds on Labor Day weekend, they will not leave on time and they'll die. I didn't buy into that, but I'm just wondering if there is a time limit on feeding them or if they just leave when
they're
ready.
Sure. And Noel, that would be one of the things a birder would want to do the least is to somehow disrupt migration. But is that something we really impact much?
That's one of our biggest myths, is that you will keep hummingbirds around if you keep your feeders out. And there's no truth at all. When a bird wants to migrate, it will migrate, regardless of what kind of food source you have around for it. And, you know, sometimes you're going to be helping late migrating hummingbirds or maybe helping some of these western species that we're seeing more and more of in the late fall to survive and continue their what they want to do. So, no, don't remove your hummingbird feeder. Later in the fall, you know, if you haven't seen a hummingbird around for 2 or 3 weeks, it's probably safe to take it down. But that could be in October, maybe even early November. So,
all right. So
certainly don't take it down now.
Well, don't worry about it, Mary. You can keep feeding them. And Marie in Milwaukee had a question about hummers, too. Hi, Marie.
Hi. And you just actually answered my question, sort of. Last year, it was October 18th. It was cold, windy, rainy, and I watched this little hummingbird sitting on our honeysuckle vine and then going over to the feeder and drinking and then going back for hours. And no, I hadn't seen a hummingbird for a couple weeks, but I just left the feeder out. And I've also had the opposite in the spring happen where I put it out really early before anybody else, and it's freezing cold, and I've had hummingbirds at it. So I was just wondering if those are just stragglers or if they're juveniles or what.
Mm-hmm. Thanks for that call, Marie. Bill, what do you think?
Probably just stragglers, just the aberrant individual that's either coming up long before the others, just caught a good wind, or somebody who didn't quite get the signal to go earlier and is still lingering late in the season. And as Noel indicated, keeping that feeder up later in the season may just be more critical than, say, right now when there's plenty of other natural food.
And Noel, anything to add?
Well, if you get a hummingbird in October, it may be something like a rufous hummingbird, which is a western species, which I've mentioned a couple times, are showing up more and more in Wisconsin, along in the eastern half of the United States in general. So in this last fall, there was a good number of rufous hummingbirds that showed up in pretty late. But we also had a record late ruby throat this last year up in Sheboygan County. I went up, and my son and a friend went up to, we figured it was going to be a non-ruby throated, but it turned out to be a ruby throated. So you do have these individuals, as Bill mentioned, that have their own time schedules, why they do what they do, and we certainly don't understand it, but you know, we all kind of march to our own beat of the drum, and certain hummingbirds do the same sort of thing.
We had an email from a listener who said, I typically feed both orioles and hummingbirds organic cane sugar, but also have some unrefined and unbleached whole cane sugar, which is much darker brown because of the molasses in it. Is this okay for these birds? What do you think, Bill?
I don't think it makes a lot of difference. There has been some concern in some of these feeding stations that maybe we're giving them some junk food. And I've noticed, for example, it was a recent trip down to Colombia where like 9 or 10 species of hummingbirds were coming in. It was just incredible, dizzying. And I did see a few birds with deformed bills, actually two of them. The question, though, is it the diet itself that is actually leading to this, or is it the fact that these birds are probably out there and we just never see them unless we lure them in with feeders? So I think the jury's still out of whether any of this is unhealthy for the birds. I think it certainly doesn't make a lot of difference what we're offering. And you know, I think just like for us, I mean, junk food, it's convenient, it's quick, and sometimes if you really need something, it's there. But you know, they're certainly taking advantage of a lot of natural food out there when that's available.
Yeah, honey is not recommended as a sugar substitute for hummingbirds.
Okay. I'm going to hold you guys right there because we have to take a look at the NPR news, but we will be back right after this. Stay tuned. Whether we know almost nothing about them or have studied them our whole lives, birds are fascinating. They add to our enjoyment of Wisconsin's great natural areas, not just by sight, but by sound as well. Hi, I'm Judith Sears Poisson, sitting in for Larry Mueller. Thanks for spending your Labor Day with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We're lucky to have two experts with us today and on most holidays to help us know what we're seeing and hearing in the world of birds. Bill Volkert has been watching and studying birds for nearly 40 years, and he spent 27 of those as a naturalist at Horicon Marsh. Bill, thanks again for joining us today.
Oh, thank you. My pleasure.
And Noel Cutright is a past president of the Wisconsin Society for Ornithology. Great to have the chance to talk with you again, Noel.
Same here, Judith.
Well, we have several people on the line. We have lots of emails and Facebook posts. So let's go back to the phones and Darlene in Mount Horeb. Hi, Darlene.
Good afternoon. I have kind of an off-season question, but about birdhouses. Every year we put up several birdhouses in our yard, and they're particularly meant for wrens, but inevitably the sparrows get one or two. But the main question is, when we're supposed to clean out the houses after the first batch of young ones has fledged, are we supposed to clean out the birdhouses then? Or should we leave them? Because inevitably they seem to, you know, maybe take out a few, a little bit of the nest and try and stuff some more stuff in there. And, you know, I can't imagine there's room for any more young birds in there, but they somehow manage. And I just wondered if that was maybe, you know, species specific or if there's a general rule for cleaning those things out.
Great. Thanks for that call, Darlene. Noel, what are some good guidelines for cleaning out birdhouses?
In general, you don't have to, but a lot of people just like to for kind of sanitation of the nest because, as you mentioned, if you don't, they'll carry a few more sticks in, and they'll leave a little bit of a cavity inside all those sticks inside it. I'm talking about a house wren now, inside of a box to lay their eggs and do the incubation and feed the young. So you can, after the first, you know, as soon as they've fledged out there, you can go ahead and clean it out if you'd like. Or just leave it to maybe later in the year when they've raised their second brood, if they do raise a second brood, and clean it out at that time. But it's not mandatory. It's kind of up to the person.
And, Bill, are there any hygiene reasons why it's a good reason to clean it out or not clean it out?
Probably the biggest concern is that some of the parasites on nestlings, like blowflies, can build up in that lower nest material. And if in your nest monitoring, if you're looking in the box periodically just to see how they're doing and what stage they're at, if you're starting to see what looks like sort of welts and wounds on these young birds that they're being fed on, then, yeah, you might want to remove that old nest material, get rid of that, the larva in there, and give them a fresh start. But otherwise, as Noel said, birds by habit will stuff a few more things in, whether they have to start from scratch over again or just add a little bit just out of habit. They'll go through those motions anyhow and start the next family.
All right. Thanks for that call, Darlene. Let's go next to Maureen in Appleton. Hi, Maureen.
Hi. Thank you for this holiday event. Really appreciate it. Can you tell me why all of a sudden downtown where there used to be swarms of nighthawks, there are none? Now, is it the lights that have been changed to the sodium or whatever you want to call it or what? But all it used to be just alive with nighthawks.
And so this is in Appleton that Maureen is talking about. Noel, any ideas?
Well, it's not just Appleton where they've disappeared. Nighthawks like whippoorwills have declined significantly in Wisconsin and in many of the upper Midwestern states where they typically nest. We really don't understand what is happening. We do know that in villages or in places like Appleton, they're nesting on gravel rooftops. There's competition with gulls, and gull predation, since they are increasing, have caused some nighthawks to disappear from our cities. But in the smaller villages, we're not sure. Even though they're building rooftops differently, a lot of them just have rubber roofs now versus putting the small stone on, which is what the nighthawks want. So I don't think it's light. I think it's probably what's happening to their habitat, maybe foraging, maybe not being able to find enough insects. I really have an issue with the number of declining insects that we're seeing, and I think they're causing maybe some food problems for birds. So Appleton is not unique at all in disappearing. We have a student at UW-Milwaukee this year who got a lot of, we mentioned citizen scientists earlier. These are volunteers that will go out and conduct studies or surveys or population counts. And she got a whole dozens and dozens of volunteers this year to go out to the designated villages and cities that she was wanting to study and do counts for nighthawks. So it's something that many of us are concerned about. We're trying to understand what is happening with their decline and see if we can, once we understand maybe why, maybe we can help recover some of these populations of nighthawks that are breeding in Wisconsin.
Well, talking about insects as a food source, Rob from Winnebago emailed, what do goldfinches feed their fledglings? Is it pre-digested seed or insects or a mix of both? And does the male ever ritualistically feed his mate? Bill?
Well, that ritualistic feeding, what we call courtship feeding, it takes place between a number of birds. It's part of that pair bonding. So as the adult male and female begin to accept each other and get ready for nesting, you'll see them oftentimes carry a seed over to a potential mate. Cardinals are probably the most obvious or most easily seen of that courtship feeding. For the goldfinches, this may take place a little bit there as well. Whether this is just to demonstrate, you know, that he's a good provider, I guess there's a number of interpretations for courtship feeding. As far as the food that they offer, the finches tend to be primarily seed eaters and not so much pre-digested. So it's not that they're actually eating that seed and starting to digest that and bringing it back up. Birds actually have a crop, so it's in that upper part of the digestive system where they can store the seed because they can't carry armloads of it. And so be able to load up a little bit more and bring that food back. That's really what they're bringing for the nestlings.
I have to say my front lawn is naturalized purple cone flowers, and just in the last few days I've had small flocks of goldfinches all perching on the top of the seed heads and going to town on those purple cone flowers.
This is the time of year all of their food is ripening and they're really going for it.
And following up on an earlier call about a differently colored cardinal, Cindy put on Facebook, I just heard the caller's comment about an orange-colored cardinal. I just saw one in my little downtown Milwaukee yard 2 days ago, bright orange. And she said that it did look like a young bird, which was what you guys were guessing.
Good.
Thanks for that. And Jackie in Milwaukee is next. Hi, Jackie.
Hi. I know you're mostly on warblers and other things. I've lived here since 1954 on a crick. In the late 50s, I inherited 5 mallard ducks that a neighbor was feeding. My group has grown till sometimes in winter I am feeding 50 to 100. Yesterday, 25 mallard ducks came in, and they were the rottenest looking, I'm sorry, ducks that I have ever seen. Their coats were rough. You couldn't tell male from female except if there was a little bit of a bright blue on the side. Are they having problems? Is there something that I should report it to? What could be happening with these mallards? I know they were mallards.
Hmm. Okay. And, well, let's see what Bill and Noel have to say. Noel, what do you think?
Well, I think they're going through their molt, so they do drop their feathers, and they look pretty scuzzy for a while as they're getting their, as they drop their old feathers and get the new feathers in. Waterfowl tend to become flightless during a period of time when they drop all their flight feathers. Most birds will just drop one or two feathers at a time so they can continue flight. But waterfowl become flightless for a period, and they're going in. You know, some of the plumages will change, too, from breeding plumage into the winter plumage. So I don't think there's anything wrong with Jackie's mallards. I think they're just going through a molt and look pretty rough right now.
And, Bill, would you agree?
Oh, absolutely. It's what we call the eclipse plumage. And my explanation for that is if waterfowl drop all their flight feathers and can't fly, why would you want to have an iridescent bright green head then? So they assume the female plumage to take on a much more camouflage. The flight feathers grow back very quickly, and then slowly as we go through now September and into October, you'll see the adult males starting to green up, and the young ones will get their first adult plumage. And by the time we get into early winter, they'll be back in good shape again and being all dressed up, ready for next spring.
Well, thanks for that call, Jackie, and hopefully we were able to put your mind at ease about your mallards, but good for you for keeping an eye on them. And Connie in Blue Mound is next. Hi, Connie.
Hello. I have a question and a exclamation point, really. For 20, 30 years, we had not seen a red-headed woodpecker in the township, and this year I have seen a lot, including a pair that nested near the house and brought the young one into the light pole between the house and the barn, and they spent a lot of time there and back and forth in the trees and didn't seem to be bothered by our presence.
Terrific.
And I'm wondering if other people have seen an increase, because driving the roads now in Blue Mounds and Springdale townships, we saw quite a few this summer.
Oh, that's exciting. Noel, is that something you've been hearing from other parts of the state as well?
Well, where there's management going on to try to enhance or increase our oak savanna type habitats, because red-headed woodpeckers love acorns. And so there's areas in the state where we're seeing some local increases in the number, like at Nisida National Wildlife Refuge up in the central part of the state. But in general, I think redheads are still not doing well at all in the state, so Connie should really be feeling fortunate that they're being successful in the Blue Mounds area.
All right. Thanks for that call. And let's go to Catherine in Wausau next. Hi, Catherine.
Hello. Wonderful program. Thanks for having this.
Thank you.
And my question is, I have lots of different birds, lots of hummingbirds, cardinals, and I'm trying to get orioles. Periodically, they will come to the hummingbird feeder and feed off of the hummingbird feeder. And I do have an oriole feeder with jelly, and it's an Audubon one. But I cannot attract the orioles. What am I doing wrong?
All right.
Or what should I do?
Sure. Bill, what do you think?
Well, she's not doing anything wrong. There's so much natural food out there that they're not really driven to the feeders. Unlike, say, when the orioles first arrive, Noel mentioned right around the 1st of May, there's not a lot of food out there for them, so they're easily lured in. And then you may have a bird that just likes the convenience and may continue to come to the feeder throughout the summer, or most of them just don't seem to look at it. And this is also why we've heard from other callers, they don't seem to notice that departure of the orioles. Well, they're sitting up in the treetops, hidden among the leaves. They're no longer singing at this time of the year. And then all of a sudden, under cover of darkness, they just take off, and you realize after a while that you just haven't seen an oriole as we get later into the fall, and they just sort of left unnoticed. So when there's plenty of food out there, it's really hard to try to tempt them. So put it out. You might find some that'll take for it. others, don't worry about it. They're feeding on other natural food where that's available for them.
And Pat in Madison is on the line, and this is a follow-up to the question about whether brown sugar or darker sugar is okay for hummingbirds, and Pat has something to add there. Hi, Pat.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Yes, I'm not a hummingbird expert, but I've been feeding them for years, and I've done quite a bit of research into what is the best thing to feed them. And I have come across several places. In fact, all the places I've ever checked about hummingbird food said you only should feed them refined white sugar, that most closely mimics the nectar they get in the wild, and that the brown sugars are the raw cane sugar. The brown on it is made of iron, and this iron can cause blood problems and can actually kill them and be harmful to them. And the only one other point I wanted to make about feeding them in the fall, some people will think it's better to add extra sugar in the fall because they need extra energy to get across, you know, through their migration. And actually, a higher concentrate than 1 to 4, one part sugar to 4 parts water may cause kidney problems. So that should be discouraged also. And I wonder what your guests would have to say to that.
Great. Thanks for that, Pat. And Noel, is that something that you've heard as well?
You see recommendations going to a 1 to 3 versus a 1 to 4 or 1 to 5. But in general, I don't think you need to at all. I tell people just to use regular white refined sugar because it's cheaper. And you can make an ounce of it for just a couple of pennies. So why spend additional money to buy more unrefined brown sugars when you can go with a cheaper, which is just as good, if not better, as Pat mentioned.
And Bill, what about the issue of the iron content in brown sugar?
That's interesting. I've not heard that myself, and I don't know about any studies on the diet's metabolism of hummingbirds, but I suppose when you're that small and you've got a heart rate of about 400 beats a minute when you're just sitting there, I suppose that, you know, little changes in their diet could affect such a small, very rapid-fire little system like that of a hummingbird. But I'm not that familiar with the, say, physiology or metabolism of the birds. But it seems like, as Noel said, white sugar, 3-to-1, 4-to-1, most people do it. It seems to work, and we don't see any serious problems with that.
And so we had an email from Jim in Cable who said, what are your thoughts on adding food coloring to hummingbird food?
Don't do it. That's all we need to say.
All right. And,
there you go, Noel.
And Noel, you obviously feel strongly about this. What's the reason for not adding it?
Well, there's really no need. I've never seen a hummingbird feeder that wasn't red in color. And that will certainly be enough to attract the birds. Why add an artificial ingredient when it's not needed?
They're attracted to the red, which is the petals of the flower, just telling them that there's food there. The color of the food doesn't make any difference. And, yeah, don't add anything artificial.
All right. Thanks for clearing that up. And, actually, let's get one more hummingbird question out of the way here with Deborah in Brown Deer. Hi, Deborah.
Hi. I was in a local park about 2 months ago, and I was – it's one of the, like, undeveloped portions of Brown Deer Park, and I, like, walk into those areas. And I was standing, and I was about to leave, and there's a chestnut tree. But a young chestnut tree with yellow blossoms and a little bit of red speckled in the middle. And it was just amazing when this happens. And hummingbirds are just like that. And here comes a hummingbird and it's getting nectar. And, you know, it's always those moments I wish I had a camera. And I went back periodically and checked on the tree to see the status and see if there were any seed pods, but someone had cut the branch off.
And so Deborah saw hummingbirds feeding at a tree. Is that unusual, Noel?
No. Wherever there's a nectar source that the hummingbirds can get to, they'll utilize it.
All right. Andrew posted on Facebook, we're very interested in what types of hawks are migrating through western Wisconsin. We've seen a lot more raptor activity on our farm, and our geese, ducks, and turkeys alert us when they're flying overhead. Bill, what would be going on in western Wisconsin right now? And is this kind of the early part of the raptor migration?
They're just beginning to move, and we may even have local movements of birds. Say the red tails and Cooper's hawks that nested nearby are now spreading around a little bit more into new feeding areas since they're no longer tied to that nest site. Yeah, it's a little early in the migration for the hawks. They'll be starting to pick up as we get through September and into the early part of October. Big flights are coming down the Mississippi River along the lake shore of Lake Michigan. Those are both north-south corridors. Hawks don't like to go over open water. There's a great hawk-watching area outside of Duluth. As they come down, hitting the north shore of Lake Superior and then funnel down, trying to avoid it going over the lake, and they get kind of squeezed then right around that area north of Duluth. And we'll see the red-tails, Cooper's hawk, sharp-shinned, the whole variety of things, broad wings. They're probably one of the more visible ones since they will tend to flock and kettle. So where we've got the rising air currents, you'll actually see a number of them gathering up on that. So it can be quite visible. But most people who are observing the hawk migration like to get on big open vistas, and especially along the site of those big corridors. So bluffs of the Mississippi River, the north shore of Lake Superior, and some high points right along the Lake Michigan shore. Excellent lookouts for hawks.
We had an email from listener Elizabeth who said, we saw a large group of turkey vultures kettling, as you just said, Bill, as we relaxed along the Wisconsin River shore south of Portage yesterday. And she asks, isn't it a few weeks early for them to be staging for migration? And it sounds like what you're saying is this is the very kind of front end of that.
Well, there again, we've got them grouping up and flocking, and you'll start to see the numbers build, but migration may yet be some time off. So there's always a little difference between that preparation of migration as flocks are starting to form and birds are moving locally, and actual migration where they're moving from point A to B, either coming south to Wisconsin, stopping, or then from here, departing and moving out.
We have time for just one more quick question. Tim in Gutenberg, Iowa. Hi, Tim.
Hello. I had a bird I saw this spring, and I haven't been able to find it in any of my bird books or on the Internet. It was April 26th, and it was on the bluffs above the Mississippi, about 20 miles south of Prairie du Chien. And it was a size maybe a little bit bigger than a nuthatch. And I was alerted to it because it had looked like black wings. And, I mean, when it was hopping through the branches in the canopy, black wings, and there was a white stripe, like along the longer axis of the bird on the wing. And then when I put the field glass on, I see it had a deep red crown and also a deep red chin with a going to a point on the breast.
How about a yellow belly
sucker? Yep.
Sapsucker.
Same thing I was thinking. Sapsucker.
A yellow-bellied sapsucker?
That white stripe is very noticeable on the side of a sapsucker. And the red on the head and the throat is right, too. So take a look at yellow-bellied sapsucker in your field guide, Tim.
All right. Well, thanks for that call, Tim.
Yeah, and good for us. We both nailed one.
There you go. That's a nice note to end on, right? Well, we have just a few seconds left. Quickly, Noel, you were saying that nighthawks and chimney swifts are something to be keeping an eye out for right about now.
That's correct. They'll be in our skies here for the next few weeks. And I also wanted to alert a talk that's tomorrow night at Urban Ecology Center at Riverside Park. Bill Miller, who's the person who walked across Wisconsin for birds this spring, is giving his first public talk about his walk.
Oh, that's great.
So 246 miles from the Mississippi back to Lake Michigan, and he'll be at the Urban Ecology Center, which is in lower east side of Milwaukee, tomorrow night at 7 o'clock.
Great. Well, Bill and Noel, thank you, as always, for spending your holiday with us. It's always so much fun.
Well,
we enjoy
you.
Bill Volkert is a naturalist and retired wildlife educator at Horicon Marsh International Education Center. Noel is past president of the Wisconsin Society for Ornithology. They will both be back with us on Tuesday, October 1st for another show. Thanks to Robin Cherry for producing today. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. Thanks for listening.